Good morning, everyone. Good to see you. Nikki, who spoke earlier, is my wife. We met at university. And I'd like to say that when she went to that first Christian meeting, I was there and our eyes met across a crowded room and it was love at first sight. But you can see how tall I am and how short she is. And that was never going to happen, was it? Never going to happen. Had to get that out of my system. Marcus said we can't say anything else about the rugby, so I'd love to, but I can't. So we'll bury that. Instead, I want to ask a question. We don't usually do interactions. This is as far as interaction is going to go this morning. But this quote, "Know thyself." Does anybody know where it comes from? There's a shout out. Completely blank faces. Any ideas?
Shakespeare,
good option. I think someone in Hamlet does maybe allude to it at some point, but it's not Shakespeare. No idea. See, now for me, it's an ancient Greek proverb, so there's no reason you'd know that. But the Matrix film, remember the Matrix film? In that, the lead character, Neo, he goes to see the Oracle to get some advice about his life, and she's an old lady, oldish lady, making cookies in a small kitchen. He goes in, they have this bizarre conversation, but her advice to Neo is this: know thyself. I think she says it in Latin, but that's what it means. Oh, I've got a picture, okay. It's not particularly dramatic, but that's the picture from a kitchen, that's Neo looking at it. That's her advice. You need to know yourself, Neo. That's good advice, isn't it? You need to know yourself. You need to know who you are. But how do you go about that? How do you do that? That story that Nick read for us from the Bible, I wonder whether that story that Jesus told might be a starting point for us to begin to explore this question. How do we know ourselves? That passage, it comes from an ancient document written by a guy called Luke, who carefully investigated his sources to write this account of the life of Jesus. The historical details he includes, they can be checked out from other sources as well. But Luke writes this document in order to make a big claim, a bold claim. He claims that there was a man who was born in Palestine, who goes by the name of Jesus, who claimed to be the Son of God, who is the Son of God. It's a huge claim to make. It's a big claim. And that's kind of what Luke wants people to know, that this Jesus is who he claims he is. But that question that Luke is trying to get across, is Jesus' claim true? Is he the Son of God? Has he got the power to change people's lives? The story that was read for us approaches that from a different angle. It approaches it from the angle of, who are we? Know thyself. It's a parable, this story. That means it's a story that has a bite to it. There's an edge to it. There's something sharp in it that is meant to unsettle us. It's a very simple story, isn't it? There are two men who go to a temple to pray. There's nothing unusual about that at that time and place. It's what lots of people did. Two men go to a temple to pray. Jesus tells us about them. He says the first one is a Pharisee. Now, if someone today were to call you a Pharisee, that wouldn't be a compliment. They'll be saying you're a hypocrite, particularly a kind of moralistic hypocrite. But if we forget that for a moment and think about this guy in this story, this character, this Pharisee, he's actually a pretty good guy. Now, he's maybe a little bit self-assured, and that some people like that, some people don't. But on the whole, this Pharisee, you can't really fault him. Now, if we take what he says at face value, he's not a robber. I think that's a commendable thing. It's good that he's not a robber. The world is full of thieves, isn't it? We've got the kind of classic Hatton Garden robbery type thing. But we've also got things like the MPs expenses scandals, where those who have been elected to represent the people have been stealing. We call a spade, theft, isn't it? We don't like that. Or we think about the fact we're still recovering from the financial collapse, which in part was caused by bankers who were trying to get stuff that didn't belong to them, which, you know, call a spade, it's theft, isn't it? Now, the Pharisee is not like that. This Pharisee is the guy who would be exposing the scandals. And when the press come knocking on his door trying to dig up some dirt on him, they would find nothing. And he's a good guy. He's not a robber. He's not an evildoer. Society would be a better place if there were more people like that. He's not an adulterer. He's a good guy. He doesn't cheat. He doesn't lie. He's faithful to his wife. He looks after the kids. He doesn't play the system. He gives to charity. Literally, he says, he gives a tenth of all that he gets. Now, in those days, there was an expectation that you gave a tenth of some that you got. But he goes above and beyond. He gives a tenth of all that he gets. He's a religious guy. He fasts twice a week. Again, that was not required, but he goes above and beyond. And this Pharisee is a model citizen. He's an upstanding member of society. I don't know what today's equivalent would be. David Dimbleby came to mind, I don't know. Anton Deck came to mind as well. You know, they can't really do anything wrong, can they, Anton Deck? They're pretty squeaky clean, I think. I don't know, I don't read enough to find out about that. The world would be a better place if there were more people like this Pharisee. But there's someone else in the story, isn't there? There's another character. There is the tax collector. Now this guy is the opposite. As far as everyone is concerned, he is the scum of the earth. He's a rogue. He's the worst kind of crook, because he's a legal crook. Now, the area at this time was under Roman occupation, and the Romans are very clever. They wanted to get taxes from the people. The way they did it was they would employ locals to get taxes from the local people. They would find someone who is willing to betray his own countrymen for money. So someone who wouldn't care about siding with the enemy. Someone without any scruples. The tax collectors would get the taxes with the backup of the local Roman military. So they've got a bit of beef behind them. But they would choose their wages by adding on to what the Romans required, whatever they wanted to pay themselves. They selected their own wages. So they basically screwed everyone over. Now this guy he's a bad guy. He's the kind of person who's prepared to steal from his own people to help the occupying forces. He doesn't give two shakes of a monkey's tail about anyone else other than himself. Now the tax collectors were a bit like the local mafia. They were known to extract money by torture. The tax collectors weren't allowed to give evidence in court because they were so untrustworthy. They couldn't give their money to charity because it was dirty money. Now this tax collector is despicable. Again, I don't know what a modern equivalent would be like. Maybe it's a bit like someone who leaves the UK to go and join ISIS. Now someone who is part of our society but goes to join an organisation committed to the destruction of it. Or when you get a suicide bomber who bombs his own community. There's something especially sickening about that. And that's what this guy is like. He's a caricature, but he's despicable. It's a short story, and there's not a lot of time to build suspense. I guess if Hollywood were to make it into a movie, they'd manage to stretch it out to a trilogy somehow. But if it was made into a film at Hollywood, we would know that despite whatever twists and turns there are in the story, at the end, the good guys win and the bad guys lose. That's why we pay the money for our cinema tickets. We want that. We want to see that happen. This summer, Mission Impossible 5 has come out. Tom Cruise, in his 90s or something, still doing his own stunts. We know the formula for Mission Impossible films. Something impossible gets done by Tom. Tom wins. And we like that. We're happy about it. One of the earlier Mission Impossible films starts with a really shocking scene. I don't know whether you've seen it. But it starts in this scene when Tom Cruise's wife is shot and Tom's watching and there's nothing he can do about it. It's really upsetting because it's quite disturbing, really. And all the way through, despite what's happening, you think, I wish that didn't happen. Now, the good guy shouldn't lose like that. And you get to the end and it turns out it didn't really happen and Tom wins and we all go home happy. It's great, isn't it? But listen, it's not just in films that we want that, is it? It's in life. In life, we want the good to be rewarded and the bad to be punished. Now, we're appalled when someone gets away with wrong. We want people to be called to account. We're even more appalled. It's more unacceptable when the bad gets rewarded. So the conclusion to Jesus' story is unacceptable. It's unfair. In the conclusion, the tax collector, the scumbag, it says he goes home justified before God and the Pharisee doesn't. Now, what does Jesus mean by that? What does he mean when he says justified before God? I like to think of it as though you're typing up a document in Microsoft Word. You type it up, you've got your page of text, and then you select it, you click on the justify button. and you get those nice, neat edges to your document, don't you? All the lines are all straight, and it looks nice. When you click on that button, it means that all the lines that come short of the edge of the page are kind of somehow brought up to standard. So when Jesus says this guy went home justified before God, he's saying this guy has been brought up to God's standard. This guy has got God's stamp of approval on him. You see why it's such a perplexing conclusion to the story. The Pharisee, the morally upright person, the religious person, he draws a blank. He doesn't get God's stamp of approval. He doesn't meet God's standard. But the tax collector, this despicable, no good waster, he does get God's approval. It's not a nice story. It's a parable. There's an edge to it. It's like finding a stone in your shoe. There's something in it that just irritates us, that gets under our skin. It's supposed to do that. And if we listen carefully to what this is saying, I think this can shift our perspective on the world. You see, it's a story that's told from God's perspective. This story is God's view on what happens. The verdict at the end is God's verdict. The stamp of approval comes from God. And from God's point of view, it seems that all the good things the Pharisee does and all the bad things the tax collector does, it doesn't make any difference. Now, God isn't sitting there and kind of seeing these two men come into the temple and think, right, I'm going to weigh up all the good they've done, all the bad they've done. He's not kind of coming in and saying, has this person done enough to get my approval? Now, God is not concerned about whether someone is good enough. Imagine God was concerned about whether someone was good enough. What would that look like? Where do you think the line of good enough would be drawn? Imagine that the world was going to be rid of all the bad people. It would be great, wouldn't it? We'd get rid of the murderers, we'd get rid of the child abusers, get rid of the terrorists. That'd be good. We'd get rid of the cheating bankers. The world would be a better place. But where would we stop? Where would that line get drawn? If we were to draw that line, who would be good enough to remain? If we're honest, maybe we're saying, well, the line would be drawn just below where I am in the moral pecking order. But if we're more honest, then we'll see that we can't really separate ourselves from contributing to what's wrong in the world. Let me tell you about a guy whose name I can't pronounce, so I'll call him Stephen. He experienced some of the worst, it's a true story, he experienced some of the worst atrocities that have happened in recent history. He was involved in the Second World War, but he was arrested in Stalin's Russia, and he was sent to one of the death camps. So he experienced many of the horrors of World War II, but he experienced loads of torture and abuse and suffering, and he reflects on what he went through. As he reflects, he writes about it, he criticises everyone, really, for what happened. And I'm reading one of his books at the moment, and he lists 30 different ways that he's experienced torture, or that he's heard of people experiencing torture, and he describes them in detail. It's sickening stuff. It's awful. It's almost unreadable to hear about it. And there's one point in his writing when he compares himself to one of the people who is torturing him, and he asks the question. He says, "Am I really that different to this guy?" You see, he's arguing that the problem in the world isn't communist or capitalist, which is the issues of the day. He says, actually, I think the problem with the world is human. And this is what he says. He said, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. They're saying, if only we could easily decide who was evil and who was not, then we could quickly sort out the problems in the world. We could separate. And he writes this. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? Now that's really why this Pharisee in the story is looking in the wrong direction. Now we're told why Jesus tells the story. It says at the beginning, he says, to some who were confident of their own righteousness. There are people who are acting like the Pharisee, who come before God and they say, God, I've done enough to deserve your approval. You know, it's like they, a modern day example. You come before God and say, God, I've done enough to get your approval. You know, I'll give you some examples, God. Just note these ones down. The other day I met some of those chuggers, you know, the charity muggers who assault you on the street and try to get your money. This time I didn't get cross, I didn't shout, I didn't swear. I actually gave something to what they were doing. I got rid of them, but you know, that's a good thing, isn't it? And God, take note of this. I'm not a murderer. I've never actually murdered anyone. I'm not a dictator like Hitler or Pol Pot. Now, take note of what I've done. Now, people like that say, God, look, on balance, you need to give me your approval. I've done what it takes. I've done enough to get a fast track into heaven. I've done enough to earn eternal happiness. But of course, everyone who says that is only half the story, isn't it? Now, the Pharisee demands his actions are rewarded, and it's as though God replies, says, look, you just don't want to play that game with me. You know, the Pharisee says, no, look at what I have done. Take it into account. God says, I know what you've done. I know everything you've done. I know what your heart is like. Do you really want to go there? Do you really want to make that bargain with me? Are you really claiming that you are perfect? You know, for what it's worth, the whole of biblical and Christian morality is summed up in two instructions. Love God and love your neighbour. It's very simple, very straightforward. If we apply that to the Pharisee, we can say, well, he's praying to God, but he's just talking about himself. It's only about himself. Does he love God or does he love himself? And as far as loving his neighbour goes, the only other person in the story is the tax collector. And he disdains him. A world full of people like that who are self-obsessed and disdain others would not be a good place to live. The line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. Now really, this Pharisee, his attempt to rely on the good that he's done, it's like saying, I can jump to the moon. Now I might be able to jump higher than the next person, but I'm not going to be anywhere near the moon. That's what the Pharisee needs to hear. Know yourself. Know what you're really like. Now, he doesn't get anywhere near God because he doesn't know himself. But on the other hand, this tax collector, he seems a bit more self-aware. Now, for all of his despicableness, and it's not as though he would have nothing good to say, is it? Now, every gangster loves his mum, don't they? He could have come and said, look, I love my mum, isn't that enough? He doesn't mention that. He realizes that before God, he can only be described as a sinner. In his life, the kind of cocktail of good and evil, like all of us, is just not good enough. Now, the doors of heaven and doors of eternal happiness are firmly closed to him. He's under no illusion about that. He knows what he deserves, so he does the only thing he can do. He goes before God and he asks for mercy. And we're going to get into the depths of it. It's not a kind of God, be nice to me type thing he's asking. He's asking very specifically that the obstacle to him being accepted by God is taken away. It's a bit like a thief who steals from the queen. Every day the thief steals a little bit from the queen, just a fiver here, tenner there, sometimes a bit more, sometimes a bit less, but keeps on doing it day after day. And the queen notices this, and so the queen starts to make an account. She starts to write it all down. And it goes on for years, and the account builds, it turns into thousands, hundreds of thousands. And then one day, the Queen throws a massive party, huge party, the party of the century. One Direction are going to be there, so Tom will probably be there as well. Tom loves One Direction. It's a great big party, and the thief comes up to the door of the palace, knocks on the door and says, can I come to your party? Well, actually he says, have mercy on me. He says, can my debt... No, my debt that I can't ever pay, can it be cancelled? He goes to the person that he stole from and says, please will you cancel my debt? Can I come into the party? I made that up, by the way. Not a true story. It's a rubbish story, isn't it, really? Completely rubbish story. It's a rubbish story, isn't it? Because no one can imagine that actually happening. No one can imagine the Queen doing anything other than saying, scumbag, go to jail. That's what you deserve. It's unimaginable. But that unimaginable story is the exact story Jesus tells here. This tax collector, he's a self-confessed sinner. He understands his relationship with God is that God has given him life and he's used his life to bring pain and misery to the world. He's stolen from God and his debt is unpayable. His debt is too much for him to pay. And yet when he goes to God and asks for God to cancel his debt, he asks for mercy, The conclusion is he goes home justified before God. He gets that VIP pass to the party. He gets welcomed with open arms. It's a story that tears open a question. It tears open a tension. How can any God do that? But how can God declare this tax collector right with him? It just throws out the rule book, doesn't it? On what is fair, on our understanding of what is right, what is just. How can a sinner, like this man, I'm a sinner, he says, how can he get VIP access? Well, this story Jesus told, it's a little passage, isn't it? It's part of a bigger story, a bigger unfolding drama. Jesus tells the story on a journey. You read around it, you see he's travelling towards Jerusalem. And he knows what's going to happen when he gets to Jerusalem. He keeps on telling people, this is what's going to happen when we get to Jerusalem. A bit after this, later on in the chapter, I'll read what he says, because he tells them again. He says he takes his followers aside, verse 31. We are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that's written by the prophets about the Son of Man, about himself, will be fulfilled. He'll be handed over to the Gentiles, to the Romans. They will mock him, insult him, and spit on him. They will flog him and kill him, and on the third day he will rise again. Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem to die. He knows that. He's absolutely sure of it. That's his mission. He's willingly going to put his life down. And his death is going to pay the debt of sinners like this tax collector. And one of Jesus' followers, a guy called Peter, he writes afterwards, he says, the Christ, Jesus, suffered once for sins on the cross, the righteous one for the unrighteous, to bring them to God. Christ suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring them to God. You see, what happened on the cross is that the tax collector, this sinner, he's built up an obstacle between him and God. He's built up this debt that he can't pay, but that he must pay. Justice requires consequence for sin, for his wrongdoing, for the evil that's in his heart. And on the cross, Jesus gives himself to pay that debt. On the cross, Jesus gives himself to bear in to bear in full the consequence of this man's sin, to meet every requirement of justice, so that the tax collector can get that stamp of approval. So this parable that Jesus told, a simple story, I think it's a parable that challenges us to think about ourselves. Know thyself. Know thyself. Do I know myself? Do you know yourself? Now this summer my dad wanted to take his granddaughters fishing, and he did. And I went and met them at a kind of kiddies fishing lake, fishing for trout. The thing about fishing is, when a fish is on the line, when it gets pulled out of the water, there is one thing for certain, that fish is supper. Now whatever happens, that fish is going to be eaten tonight. But the fish comes out, he doesn't know that yet, does he? He's still flapping around like crazy. It's great to kind of do this with the kids, and then you put it on the side, still flapping around. It doesn't know what's happening. It doesn't know that it's dead. You hit it on the head, and blood spatters a little bit. The kids enjoy that bit, kind of. But he's still flapping around. He doesn't know that he's dead. And maybe that's the difference between the Pharisee and the tax collector. The Pharisee doesn't know that he's dead. Now he thinks that he can get life. He can find eternity, he can get acceptance from God because of his actions. But his goodness is not good enough. In fact, from God's perspective, he's morally indistinguishable from the tax collector. And he doesn't know that he's dead. And the reason I say he doesn't know he's dead is because he doesn't ask for mercy. Now, the Pharisee and the tax collector both need mercy. The only difference is one of them asks. I don't know what you make of this story, what we've thought about it this morning. Now, if you're a Christian, if you have accepted the Lord Jesus as your Saviour, if you've done that, let me ask you: do you identify with the Pharisee or the tax collector? And I ask that because I just wonder whether we have a kind of inbuilt tendency, we don't like to say it, but an inbuilt tendency to be like the Pharisee. Right, I'll give you a couple of examples. The first one is when we come to pray. And when we come to pray to God on our own, we're a kind of mix of emotions usually. Different things are going on. Sometimes we come, we're very confident. We address the maker of the universe. We tell him everything. We ask him for all things. But the confidence we have is because we think we're having a good day. Now we think, today I made a real special effort with my grumpy boss. I was really kind to him. I didn't rise to him taunting me. I even read the Bible a bit this morning. I'm having a really good day. God will be really happy with me. He will accept me today because I've done all these great things. And, of course, the opposite is true as well. If the day's been really rubbish and I've been foul with my family and I feel really bad, then the idea of praying comes across my mind, but I think I'm just too bad to talk to God today. Or how about when we think about bigger things, the questions of life and death? Now maybe something happens. Maybe a friend dies. Maybe we hear of someone dying, and it makes us think about our own death, and we're afraid, and we don't really, not really scared about what will happen when we, in the kind of process of dying, but what happens after that? And we think, well, when I come before God, what will happen? Is eternal happiness really open to me? Have I done enough to get that? And if in any way we relate to those patterns of thinking, well, then we're relating to the Pharisee. He was trusting himself. He was relying on his own actions. But when you look at the tax collector, he shows that life is not found in what we can do for ourselves, but life is found in what God can do for us. But the tax collector teaches we can be confident when we pray. We can be sure when we die, because God is merciful to those who ask. But if you're not a Christian this morning, if you're not sure about this whole kind of Christianity lark, what it's about, you've got some questions. Might I ask you the same question too? Now, in this parable, who do you identify with? The Pharisee or the tax collector? Now, would you build your confidence in life on what you can achieve and then hope that will be enough? Hope that your efforts will be enough when life ends and eternity beckons? Now, both the Pharisee and the tax collector needed mercy. But only one of them asked. That's the difference between them. And you know, if you've not asked God for mercy, then, well, he's listening. It doesn't need to be a fancy prayer. It can be as undramatic as what this tax collector does here. There's nothing special about it. It's just simple words. But it will be heard.